The travelers are returning.
Cease review.
What a trip, Bones. Orion at the dawn of its civilization. Even just observing, not touching anything for fear of changing some piece of history. What's the matter? Bones?
Who's he, Jim?
What do you mean, who's he? You know Mr. Spock.
Right, I don't, Jim.
Transfer complete.
Hello and welcome to Subspace Transmissions, the podcast where two Trek fans step into the arena and tackle the best, worst, weirdest, wildest, and everything in between that Star Trek has to offer. I'm Cam Smith, and joining me on the bridge,
this is Tyler Orton, and his mouth is moving differently than the words coming out of said mouth.
All I'm seeing is like a silent death mask on you across the table.
Well, Cam, why would my mouth be moving differently than the at a different pace than the words coming out of it?
Because this week we're going to talk about Star Trek Lower Decks and other animated adventures.
Are you saying that animation is not always like at peak performance?
Is that a Star Trek Next Generation season two reference?
Completely unintentional here. Yeah. But we had the news come out of about a week or two ago that Star Trek would be pursuing officially a new series called Star Trek Lower Decks. The hook is that it's following the lives of kind of those junior officers whose job it is to say, replace the food cartridges in the replicators, and maybe, I don't know, you and I speculated in a video that we did on YouTube that maybe they're going to be more of the maintenance crews.
Waste extraction,
or else, I don't know, the people that have to clean the isolinear chips every couple weeks or something.
Right.
Which tells me that this is really going to be a character-based show, as opposed to, like, these explosive adventures that we're used to seeing the senior crew members handle, you know, week to week.
Like peak performance.
So we did talk briefly about our initial reactions to this, and I think you and I are actually both on board, and I wonder if general fans are. It's kind of curious, like I think that you and I think there's actually a lot more potential here for a really solid series than general fandom here. But just for those who may not have heard our thoughts last week, why do you think something like this actually works for the world of Star Trek, Cam?
I think for a couple of reasons. Number one, I think Star Trek needs to diversify. I think they've probably learned from Lucasfilm in that if you crank out very similar product close together, it can kind of blur together. So if you have, you know, Discovery on the air and you have another show come out that's too similar, well, suddenly the average person who's just tuning in is like, I can't keep track of which show's which.
Yeah.
And so if you have one that's drastically different, like this promises to be, this Lower Deck show, then hey, maybe people who don't like Discovery might like, you know, Lower Decks. Maybe people prefer Discovery to Lower Decks. Like, there's more just to chew on for fans, and then they can kind of bicker amongst themselves which one they like more and why, which is fun. It just adds to the conversation.
Well, it reminds me very much back in the 90s when there's the people that just like watching Deep Space Nine and the people that just like watching Voyager.
Yeah, which is awesome. I think it's good for fandom to have these debates going, and I think when handled well, they can be really entertaining to have, not like some of the online ones we see, but you know.
Yeah.
But also, and I've talked about this in the past, going back a ways, I think Star Trek is doing kind of a poor job in continuing its growth of fandom. I don't think it's grabbing young people as much as it should be. If it wants to continue into the next era, you know, you look at a lot of the franchises that are going today, the ones that are really, really going strong, they are very appealing to young kids. Star Trek does not have that. And so an animated show, I mean, I don't know how this show is going to be pitched, what age group Lower Decks will be pitched at, but it's something I hope that will maybe draw younger people in that would never tune into an episode of Discovery or a rerun of Next Generation.
We'll talk about it a little later on in the show, but you look at the animated series, and I think that was clearly geared towards younger audiences. Like, it was a kid's show.
Sure.
That one that, you know, adults could watch.
An Emmy award-winning kid's show.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
And so with this, I think when we heard a couple months ago that Alex Kurtzman had signed a new contract with CBS, and he'd be shepherding a whole bunch of new series, and among them would be an animated series. I think you and I just initially assumed that the animated series would be more geared to children.
Right.
I think you and I believe it makes sense at this. I think this Star Trek Lower Decks is not necessarily going to be a kids show. If you look at who's behind it, it mm-hmm. is a gentleman who's currently a writer for Rick and Morty, which is more of a adult geared like,
sure.
comedy show, and not adult and like risque, but
not like Fritz the Cat.
Were you a big Fritz the Cat fan?
Oh, who wasn't, Daddy-O?
Okay. What was the Gary the Rat? Was that one that you, with Kelsey
Grammer? Gary the Rat.
Kelsey Grammer was Gary the Rat?
I have no knowledge of that one. Okay. I remember Duckman with Jason Alexander.
Yeah, Duckman was another thing. But I think this will be more kind of like a Simpsons sort of show where it's going to appeal to both young audiences as well as older audiences. And I think this is actually a far smarter thing to do than just doing like a kids show that I think, honestly, a lot of the older fans might just mock it,
right.
or it might not hold interest to the older fans who I think they still are trying to appeal to. I think this is kind of the perfect balance of reaching out to both demographics.
And if this show is really fun, like tweens will think it's cool, and a lot of kids don't think Star Trek's cool. Some of them learn that it is later down the road when they get more into some of these shows, but I feel like if you ask your average 11-year-old now if they think Star Trek's cool, the answer is probably no.
Well, do you think that many mainstream audiences were drawn in from the J.J. Abrams movies into the kind of the hardcore fandom? Like, my sense
is... It doesn't feel like they were.
But those movies made so much, and it's kind of weird that, you know, it doesn't seem as if it kind of translated into, you know, the television like, appreciation.
But it is one of those things. Like, just because a movie's successful doesn't mean that makes people want more. You know, Venom just came out. Venom has made a lot of money. How many of these audience members who are flocking to see Venom are running out to buy Venom comics?
Yeah.
Probably a very small number. And how many of them are right. diehard Venom fans?
If there's a Venom TV series, are they going to tune in week to week?
I mean,
probably
maybe.
Not.
Maybe if Tom Hardy's in it and it looks just like the movie, but no.
Yeah.
You know, it takes a lot to convince someone to jump from a two-hour movie into something broader. You know, that's kind of what fandom's for, is they are the people willing to make that leap. But I feel like the general person doesn't. You know, there's tons of movies, franchise movies. You know, my parents enjoy the heck out of. They're not going to sit and watch a TV show based on this.
Did they never watch The Young Adventures of Indiana Jones? Or The Adventures of Young Indiana Jones?
Not only did they not watch it, I've never even seen a single episode.
You haven't seen a single episode?
No. I read two novelizations, though.
Okay.
I didn't even know where it was, like, on or when. I had no knowledge as to when that show aired.
I think it was on, like, ABC, and it was, I think, on a little later in the evenings than maybe I would be able to watch it. And I remember catching two episodes, and even as a kid, I thought it kind of stunk.
Right.
Yeah. So, well, from my perspective here about why this actually makes sense, I'll take it from more of kind of the creative angle. I think if you are focusing on kind of more of these junior crew members, you're kind of subverting our expectations for Star Trek, because it's not as if these are going to be like the Cadet Tilly, Cadet Noggs, or the Ensign Satos, Ensign Kims that are thrust into exceptional circumstances.
Right.
These are going to be kind of junior, lower-rung officers that are doing kind of the monotony of the job. It's subverting our expectations about what Star Trek is all about, and I think Star Trek's best when it is subverting our expectations. You look at, you know, say the TNG series. It really didn't work in its first two seasons because it kind of seemed like a lame imitation of the original series, trying to recapture some of that magic with similar storytelling. Mm-hmm. As soon as they switched it around and started focusing more on, say, the main cast members episode to episode versus, say, you know, the villain of the week or the alien of the week.
The outrageous Okona.
Yeah, I know. Oh, dear. But as soon as they kind of subverted that, the series got really, really strong.
Right.
And then you jump over to Deep Space Nine. They're not traveling through the bounding through the stars every week. They are on a space station. It's stationary. You're subverting kind of our expectations for Star Trek with something like this. Yes, you are subverting it once again. I think that works really creatively. It's going to actually give us so many more possibilities than, you know, if we're doing this Picard spinoff, if we're doing Star Trek Discovery, I think there is a bit of a risk that's, yeah, we're treading on ground we've been before.
Right. No, I 100% agree.
Yeah. The other thing is, it looks as if this is going to be kind of a comedy,
right?
I think if you try to do comedy in live-action Star Trek, it has a very mixed track record.
I don't know what you're talking about.
Yes. I just go back to, I think the worst line in Insurrection had to be Data going to Worf and asking if his boobs are firming up. when it was like, they tried to play it for laughs, but they had the most awkward cut to an action scene. If anybody thought it was funny, you didn't even have the chance to laugh at it. It just, Star Trek and comedy, there's been some good examples of it.
Like B4 in Nemesis.
I know. But yeah. Comedy is really tough to do.
Definitely.
I think, look, you're getting a professional comedy writer. This guy's written, Speculative Season 8 on a Twitter account for Star Trek The Next Generation. It was a comedy account. I've read the tweets. It was funny. He's done an entire book on kind of like a Star Trek, or like comic series on Star Trek The Next Gen. This is going to be like a funny show. And I think you do it best if you're doing a kind of an animated. I think you are able to kind of get away with so much more through animation than you would be able to do so comedy-wise on a live-action series.
And we should say that the creator / showrunner of this Star Trek Lower Decks, his name is Mike McMahon, and my favorite credit of his is that he was a producer on 2016's Phantasm Ravager.
Oh, I'm not familiar with what
which would be the fifth chapter in the Phantasm film series.
Okay. Yeah. So, look, I think you've got somebody who's clearly going to, you know, put his all into something that he has a lot of reverence for. Mm-hmm. And I heard, you know, I mean, I know it's social media, whatever, but there were fans saying, like, Star Trek's not supposed to be silly. It's supposed to be super serious. I'm like,
there's no silly Star Trek episodes.
Well, I know. But, you know, I think this is kind of the perfect medium. If you want to do a comedy series, look, you're going to get so many different opportunities to just kind of explore Star Trek in a whole new way. And again, maybe, you know, I don't want to do too much the Orville talk here.
Right.
But I think it's interesting in that the Orville was actually, it's been successful so far for Fox. And I know a lot of Star Trek fans actually prefer the Orville over Star Trek Discovery.
Sure.
Sure. Yeah. I think our longtime listeners know that I did watch season one of the Orville. I gave my little mini reviews every single week. The show, it was more of kind of a lighter version of Star Trek The Next Generation. My biggest problem with it is that it had the opportunity to kind of subvert our expectations of kind of a sci-fi franchise like Star Trek all the time. And I think that Galaxy Quest did that quite well. The Orville, I found myself like maybe smiling once an episode. But it really, it kind of subverted my expectations. The one example I can think of that I still do like is when, you know, the captain is in turbo lift and he was having like kind of confrontation, and then an alien crew member with them was like, we should get some music into this turbo lift here. You know, right. I'm like, yeah, that's a good point. How many turbo lift, you know, conflicts have we seen? And it's just like this silent turbo lift, you know? Yeah. Again, describing comedy is always great for laughs.
Yeah, yeah.
But
if you want to hear more on that, we have an episode called When Star Trek Does Comedy.
It was perhaps our least funny episode we've ever done on the show.
It was grimly serious.
Yeah, yeah. But, you know, I think it was actually for a live-action series like the Orville. Look, it's a lighter series. I think that's kind of the way to go. But I don't think that it would work for Star Trek because, again, I think too many whole Star Trek in just complete reverence. Mm-hmm. But it's amazing to think that those same people would, I guess, cast shade at Star Trek Discovery for not being as good as the Orville.
Right.
You know, it's just like, okay. But so I think CBS recognizes that maybe there is kind of a market for doing a lighter version of Star Trek.
Yeah, and it makes total sense to me because it's just, again, it's a different angle on something, and I don't think that's a bad thing. You know, you look at the success of Marvel films. Hey, some people may not like Doctor Strange, but they might love the Guardians of the Galaxy or Ant-Man. You know, like, there's different ways into the franchise that people can grab hold of, and it's nothing but good for everyone. Because I think a lot of Star Trek fans who are really, really down on Lower Decks, hey, don't watch Lower Decks then. Like, it doesn't matter.
Exactly.
But ultimately, it just leads to more potential for expanding the franchise and giving you new outlets for it. And, I mean, look, right now, all they have is Discovery. And if they don't like Discovery, well, that's that. And we don't know what's going on with the J.J. Abrams universe. And
they still don't want to pay Chris Pine.
Yeah, they're still holding out.
What is up with that?
I don't know. But
they have a script. They have a director.
Yeah.
They don't want to pay this star.
I know.
He's under contract. They want to get out of their contract with him.
Yeah.
Anyway, sorry, Cam.
Yeah, but, you know, yes, we have Picard coming, but I think it's awesome if we can just get more growth as Star Trek as a franchise, because I think we saw with shows like Voyager and Enterprise, which I like. I definitely really liked the last couple seasons of Enterprise a lot. I don't know that they were doing a great job in expanding what Star Trek could be.
It felt a little samey.
Right.
You know?
Even though, like, it was, you know, some really great stuff in there, and we did our best of Voyager recently, and we had some really, really great episodes in there, but ultimately, when things feel samey, they don't bring in a lot of new eyes, and you tend to lose the existing eyes, you know? Look at how many bands eventually, you know, you see they'll hit their peak and then they kind of fade out. And they're still playing, they're still successful, but you kind of have just that core group that are left. And well, I don't think that's good for Star Trek's longevity.
I think Billy Corgan said that every band has about 3 albums in them, and then it's just kind of, you know, like, tails off from there.
Sure.
I wonder, so does that mean Star Trek only has 3 good series in them and then it's tailing off?
I would say nowadays in the world of franchises, you just never know.
Exactly.
You just never know when you're going to have some sort of entry that comes out and just explodes.
But it almost seems as if we're now in kind of a post-Star Trek world in terms of the creative forces that would be driving these new series. In that, like, the 90s era of Star Trek, I think, was so influential on so many creative types that are out there right now.
Right.
They're now the ones that
like get... Like the Orville.
Yeah, well, exactly. No, it's true, though. But now they're the ones that get to be kind of the decision makers creatively and kind of realize they're the ones that were inspired so much by what the 90s brought them. And I think it's interesting to see how they're going to kind of reinterpret this. I think the worst thing you can do is if, let's say you wanted to do a light Star Trek comedy series, you decide to do live action and just kind of emulate the Berman era aesthetics. It would just kind of be like you said, Cam, very samey, derivative. Are you really capturing new audiences? No, I think you're just, you know, tapping into...
Like the base.
The base, yeah. And Star Trek needs to expand right now. If we want to keep going to Star Trek conventions for the next few decades, you and I in our 80s, probably not going to cover all...
Only the cast of Enterprise left?
Yes. I'm pretty sure Shatner will be...
Oh, yeah, he's still
going there, yeah. But
it'll be just like a head in a jar.
Well, yeah, kind of like Futurama.
Yeah.
Yeah. Speaking of animated series.
Yeah.
So, you know, maybe why don't we kind of talk a little bit about what we hope from the series? What era do you think it would make sense to set this? Like, my initial thought was the 24th century, but that was before we knew kind of like a Picard spinoff, where it was kind of a done deal.
Right.
I don't think we need to go back to the 24th century, but what are you thinking?
The cynical side of me says it's going to be 24th century.
Yeah.
I just feel like, first off, you have that episode Lower Decks, which is in the 24th century. This writer has done this potential season 8 of Next Generation. Like, I feel like that's where his love is of that 24th century era and probably the aesthetics that go along with it.
Perhaps.
And so, I don't know that that's necessarily what excites me, but it feels like if you're going to do something that's comedy-based, it might be fun to set it in a very well-established universe and then play with that universe as opposed to, say, leaping into the 25th, creating an entirely new universe, and then trying to poke fun at the tropes of it.
I agree with you there.
That's kind of a problem. So to me, it's really between 24th or 23rd what they decide to go with.
I think, you know, I was thinking we really had like 3 options, you know, for the same reasons you were saying. It's like, how much fun can you have in a 25th century set series where it's so unfamiliar to the audiences?
Right.
Where
you can't make fun of menial jobs when you don't even understand what the main jobs are.
Well, exactly.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I agree with you. Like, the cynical part of me would say 24th century, but I think fundamentally they're not going to do 24th century because I think you get more into that risk of, like, this Picard spinoff. He's going to be in that era right then and there. So,
but he's a new traveler, so he's just... journeying the cosmos now.
Sure, sure.
Like V'ger.
Okay.
So that's nothing like the 24th century anymore.
I think I've lost what you're trying to say.
That's just my hypothetical view on what the Picard spinoff it will be.
Okay. But I think if I was a betting man, I think that 22nd century just isn't known enough. You know, we're talking kind of the Archer era.
It is not going to be set in the Archer era.
No.
And no way.
Look, as a pure Star Trek fan, I would be interested in, to see what comes during kind of the birth of the Federation.
Sure.
You know, like, so just after the Archer era. My guess, though, if I was a betting man, would be around the kind of peak James Kirk Spock era.
Really? Interesting.
And the reason why, it's for pure marketing purposes, it's really easy to put these characters in those kinds of uniforms, and it'll be super recognizable. You also have kind of very familiar ship designs. You see what they're doing with Star Trek Discovery. Very different aesthetics that they're going for with regards to an era that's only 10 years before, you know, Kirk and Spock at their peak.
Right.
So this, I think they can actually play around with what we kind of expect from that particular era, and it's going to be recognizable enough to the fans, and it's also going to be recognizable to the non-fans as well, and probably draw them in and say, okay, this could be fun to play around with what's going on. I just think it would be weird creatively for them to go beyond the 23rd or 24th century. I just don't know if that would work.
Right. No, I agree 100%. Don't you feel, though, like we're kind of at a point post-TOS nostalgia? I feel like that was all wrapped up in the 50th, but I feel like people are now getting more nostalgic about TNG. Like, that has really come back into frame for me.
Okay. No, I 100% agree with you. I just, I'm a little, like, wary of this because I just think the Picard spinoff is going to be going on about the same time that this is going to be premiering as well.
Right.
Do they really want two contemporaneous series? Like, I would say absolutely not. That we already had that with DS9 and Voyager, and I think there's kind of, that kind of added to the oversaturation factor that was going on in the 1990s. I think if we do have something set in the 24th century, let's just be honest, let's just set it in the 2370s,
right?
You know, like at the peak TNG era. You know, let's just be cynical about it, and, you know, like, at that point.
It would be amazing if they set it around the time of season one of TNG and they had the old uniforms.
I actually think
that would be really funny.
I think that would actually, like, make fans none too pleased, though.
Oh, come on.
Yeah. what about kind of, say, aliens that you want to see, though? Like, I think we can be very creative here in that, like, this is an animated series. Like, it's not going to be hung up with, say, some of the aesthetics or the budgetary constraints just because it's not going to have some. It's essentially, you're putting pen to paper. And I know nowadays it's all done with computers, blah, blah, blah. And some computer animation is going to cost more, blah, blah, blah. But I think they have so many more opportunities to kind of spread their wings here and kind of do pretty much anything they want with any sort of alien.
Yeah, that's one of my biggest complaints with just Star Trek as in general, is that due to budget, they can't fill the bridge full of aliens. And Star Trek has so many amazing aliens.
Yeah.
And with animation, you can just fill the frame with them. And you are not, you know, held victim by makeup time and all that sorts of stuff that these live-action shows are. So, hey, I want my Andorian on the bridge. I want my Tellarite on the bridge. Like, I want this entire vast variety of aliens represented on the show.
The problem is we're not going to be on the bridge. It's the lower decks.
You know what I mean. Yeah. I'm saying that, you know, they can cut to the bridge and have these characters. But also just in the hallways, I want...
You want the Andorian in the Jeffries tubes.
Like, sure.
That's what, you know,
I want them everywhere.
Scrubbing the Jeffries tubes.
In scenes where they're in hallways, I just want, like, rows and rows of Andorians and Tellarites and the odd Orion, you know, that sort of stuff.
And I think the reason why I kind of bring up the animation factor here, though, is, like, there's just some aliens that are kind of hard to conceive doing week to week, just live action. I think mostly of, say, Captain Baudet from Star Trek Deep Space Nine, who Data Jadzia. He was the one we all knew had the transparent skull,
yeah.
But we never got to actually see him realize. I think that was actually just a fantastic ongoing joke within the series. So whatever his species was, I'd love to see him week to week. I also wonder if there'd be the opportunity for, I don't know, say an 8472 to make an appearance, and just what they can do interacting, you know, animation-wise with our lower deck crews.
Well, I would just love if they were willing to kind of, in an animated show, grab various aliens from the history of the franchise and just throw them in for fun.
Yeah.
Like, I think that's something that is not easy to do in just your live action show. You're going to have to maybe fit one in. You know, well, that might be where your budget goes that week. But in an animated show, they can just bring in all the aliens from the history of the franchise. I always think of that animated episode of the original animated show from the 70s, Time Trap, where there's like a council and it's just all the different aliens we've seen in Star Trek at that point. And yeah. I love how animation can do that. I also think of, there's a He-Man Masters of the Universe Christmas special. And I bought it at Walmart a couple years ago for like, I don't know, $4 or something to relive my youth. And boy, was it tough to relive my youth watching it. But there was a scene where it's just a Christmas party in Eternia. And all of these classic He-Man characters are just standing in the background. They're not even moving because of the animation. But I absolutely loved picking them out in the background because it was just so much fun. That's what I want Star Trek to do, is just have all these iconic aliens that can only be afforded to be put in an episode or two, have them just filling out the background.
What if you wanted a Mugatu in Discovery?
Oh, yeah.
That's going to be pretty pricey.
Or that's your feature of the week, basically, that episode.
Throw them into any episode of Star Trek Lower Decks. It's not going to be such an issue.
New security chief.
Why not? Yeah, I'd love to see that. That'd actually
be pretty effective.
Yeah. I think we've got a lot of opportunities to really kind of explore just the aliens that kind of get sidelined. Because the other problem I have with Star Trek sometimes is like just these vast majority of the crews are human.
Right.
And it's, budgetary issue. And we also understand that humans, founded what we now know as Starfleet. So, okay, I can rationalize it in my own brain. But it is kind of disappointing because you think about all the diversity persistent throughout this galaxy that's been established here. And I don't know, I'd like to see that realized more frequently on screen, and whether it's animated or not. The other thing, though, I think, is that this is going to be a series that lends itself quite a bit to a lot of like inside jokes or like references, or you'll just see images on screen that would be difficult to do in a serious show like Star Trek Discovery. And there's going to be something that makes you go like, oh yeah, I get where you're coming from.
Well, you can do sight gags in a way that the previous series just never really could.
Yeah. The other thing to keep in mind, though, is actor cameos in which...
Oh, yeah.
If you have, Jonathan Frakes appear on the Picard spinoff, it's going to be different than the Riker that we remember him. If Jonathan Frakes is lending his voice to a hypothetical Star Trek Lower Decks set in the TNG era, he could be on a view screen or something like that. It's going to be the Riker that we remember. I think that's going to be kind of fun.
Yeah.
Same with, like, say, a Data. He can always be this android that is kind of this, looks very much the same. Whereas Brent Spiner will even be the first to admit that he doesn't really look like the Brent Spiner of 35 years ago.
Right.
Although maybe he will disagree. I don't know.
Well, there was the discussions and kind of rumors that Brian Fuller wanted to do a CG Data at some point.
Yeah.
And I don't know how that would look. CG is hit or miss. But in animation, you can take a character like Data and make him eternal. Like, that character can continue as long as Brent Spiner feels like doing the voice.
Well, exactly.
Which is another, 30, 40 years or something.
Yeah. So, yeah, I don't know. Like, we can easily see like a lot of cool characters returning. It also makes me think, and we go back to maybe more Seth MacFarlane talk, but he did that before in, with Family Guy. He'd have Stewie kidnap the cast of Next Generation, and we got to see them in animated form and their uniforms and everything.
Yeah.
And, it's not hard to, kind of buy it. You know, it's not like you're looking at people that are kind of shells of what your memories were from 30 years ago.
And there was all that eye-rolling drama about William Shatner. Will he or won't he be in the next Star Trek movie and all that sort of stuff. And we can have, if they did it around a timeline that you referenced earlier, like, you could have Shatner play Kirk one more time in a way that's completely natural, that doesn't involve having to sell the audience on, 80-something-year-old Shatner on screen in a Star Trek uniform. It's like, there he is as an animated image, and it'll completely work. And I think that could be super fun.
So the Shatner that we know now is different from the Shatner we got to know 50 years ago.
Yeah.
In that, like, Shatner's almost playing a parody of himself if you see him at conventions.
Yeah.
It would be interesting to see what his acting technique would be, you know, just to emulate maybe himself from yesteryear. Again, not meant to be a pun about something we might talk about later on.
Right.
But yeah, I think the Shatner idea would be, like, a lot of fun to do. Yeah, I think the potential for this is really astounding. I think we may have spoken about this on the video or else maybe briefly last week, but what do you think about the kind of ship that would make sense? Like, do you think we're going to be experiencing these lower deck crew members on, say, one of the most, you know, spectacular ships that we've ever seen in Star Trek? Or do you think it's going to be one of the more kind of rinky-dink sort of vessels?
I don't know. And I think part of the issue is I don't know whether they want the comedy to come from the fact that it's like they're on the greatest ship in the universe and they're the lowly people.
Yeah.
So, you know, whether it's the Enterprise or, you know, another top-ranking ship. Or they want the comedy to come from they're in, like, the crappiest ship in the fleet. And not only are they on the crappiest ship, they're at the lower ranks of it. I don't know what works better. I mean,
I'll tell you, like, I think a lot of the good character stuff is going to be coming from the monotony of the job. And
yeah.
I think a lot of the good, you know, storylines that could come from that is, say, the monotony of the missions that they're on. And
sure.
So I think if they're on missions that are more akin to, say,
the Trouble with Tribbles, yeah. Where it's like the grain one?
Yeah, with they're like protecting grain.
Yeah.
I think that would be more interesting. So that, to me, lends itself to something where it's more of kind of a lowly science vessel, like kind of more on the outskirts as opposed to where the center of action is always going to be.
Right. No, I mean, that definitely makes sense. But I could totally see them also going the alternate of like, this is the most amazing ship and you guys are doing nothing.
Yeah.
Which is also kind of funny.
So it can maybe for our listeners, and we haven't, you know, firmed up everything at this point, but how do you think you and I should be tackling this series when it premieres in probably, let's be honest, like maybe 2 years? It takes a while to animate things.
Right. They're drawing as fast as they can.
Yeah. What was the great Simpsons line?
Was it about live television or yeah. something like that? Yeah. It's a strain on the artist's wrists.
Yeah. But I think for us, like, no doubt we'll be covering the season premieres.
Definitely.
You know, and we do wonder how much in depth we can go, you know, episode to episode. I'm assuming these are going to be like 20, 25 minute long episodes, right?
Probably.
So I figured maybe we'll, you know, check in on the series like once a month and mm-hmm. Do like an episode by episode kind of deep dive into everything that's gone on there and just talk a little bit about what's working within this. Whereas I think it still makes sense for us to continue doing, you know, these deep dives episode to episode every week when, say, Star Trek Discovery comes back.
And more Short Treks.
More Short Treks. You know, stay tuned to the end of this episode to find out what we're covering next.
Yeah, of course.
Yeah, so I don't know. Any final thoughts on kind of the potential here for Star Trek Lower Decks?
I'm really excited for this because I feel like the sky is the limit for what they can do with this premise and this just the universe of this show. I don't feel like it's tacked down in a way that's not that interesting to me. Like, a show like this Picard spinoff, I don't know where Picard is going to be in his life, but I have a general sense as to what the universe he's going to be inhabiting is.
Yeah.
Whereas this Lower Decks, I just don't know, because you can go with animation, you can go fairly similar to the reality of the live-action shows, like a show we might talk about in a little bit, or you can go completely off-the-wall wacky, like a show like Rick and Morty.
Or, you know, like a show we're going to talk about in a little bit.
Also accurate. But, you know, I mean, Mike McMahon, he also worked on South Park for a little bit. You know, that's another show that's completely wacky. Like, you don't really know what Lower Decks could be. It could be anything. And that's exciting to me.
Yeah. Well, Cam, speaking of that, let's talk about Star Trek's first foray into animation with Star Trek the Animated Series.
Yeah.
You know, we've actually spoken about a couple of these episodes over the years. And it was funny when I was going into Netflix to do a little bit of research here. It surprised me by how many of these episodes I've actually watched over the last couple years we've been doing the podcast. It's also surprising. I had no idea that season two was only like six episodes.
Yeah.
I was just like, oh. So I ended up watching four more, and I think I'm like more than halfway through the series, the entire series at this point. So I do think I have an okay grasp on maybe what worked and what didn't work. But for you, what is kind of the appeal of an animated series continuing the adventures of the original crew?
Well, I mean, first off, the original crew got cut short at 3 years, and they were on a 5-year journey. So just the mm-hmm. idea of, you know, adding more adventures to what that crew could be. You know, there's always the ongoing, is it canon or is it not canon with the animated series? But I know, like, for example, DC Fontana said she viewed this as, like, the 4th year of their adventure. So at least I can, in my head, rewrite it, be like, maybe these are the adventures that could have happened in live action if they had had the money.
Yeah.
And so, to me, a lot of the joy becomes, you know, getting to see what might have been in an alternate universe, but also what Star Trek could be with unlimited money and just having these amazing animated creatures. You know, there's an episode near the end of the run of the series where they encounter this entity that inspired the Mayans. And it is this sort of Mayan god-like figure, and the animation on it is so weird and unusual and crazy that I just love looking at it. And that's something to me that I think the original series was actually pretty amazing at visuals, even though they were working on a shoestring a lot of the time. But the animated series just really untethered them from any sort of limitations that a live-action show had. So you could have incredible visual creatures that just weren't tied to, how's this actor going to work in the suit? How are they going to work with two legs? You know, it's just like, no, they fly around all over the room.
Yeah, what was the name of the helmsman, or the one who is often next to Sulu, because they wouldn't pay Walter Koenig any money, but that character
who had
like multiple limbs.
Yeah,
and, like, it's just kind of like, oh, I like this. We also had kind of the feline crew member as well on the bridge, where it's like their budget wasn't there to have all these aliens on the bridge every single week, especially in the 1960s shoestring budget. So I like how it could really open up our imaginations.
Yeah, I mean, look, I always felt bad for Walter Koenig not getting the paycheck, but I do love seeing these characters on the screen as well. Yeah. Like, it just adds to the diversity of a Star Trek crew.
Was Jimmy Doohan, like, sucking up the paycheck that Koenig would have gotten? Considering, like, every single time I heard an alien voice, I was like, that's James Doohan's voice right now.
Yeah, him and Shell Nichols did a lot of voices. Majel Barrett did quite a few.
Yeah.
It's like,
they're earning their keep, where I think, did someone tell us, it may have been George Takei at a previous convention, but the paycheck that they were getting, it wasn't big at all. Like,
no.
It would even make us scoff, like, back in the day. It was, like, within, like, week to week, like, worth a couple $100s.
Mm-hmm.
You're like, wow, okay, guys. Like, how cheap were the company behind the animation that they wouldn't even put money out for those?
Well, Filmation was known for working super cheap. Like, most of their productions were fairly basic in terms of their animation costs and all that sort of thing. And you can tell when you watch a show. But interesting little factoid, this was the most expensive children's show on the air.
Okay.
Which tells you a lot about 1970s animated TV shows. And a lot of it had to do with paying the cast.
Yeah. But you know what? As I watch it,
mm-hmm.
I felt as if there's a lot of cool things going on. And then other episodes, I was like, maybe glancing at my phone.
Yeah,
you know?
Oh no, I 100% understand.
But I think what drew me in consistently episode to episode is the fact that the cast is there doing their voices. If they got, like, fake voice actors to do that, this would have been, I think, unbearable to watch in parts. Like, despite the fact that there were some good adventures that we got to see.
Yeah, oh, for sure. I mean, I guess thankfully or unfortunately for the cast of the original series, a lot of them weren't getting work at this point in time, and so they were available to do this show. Whereas you look at a lot of the properties now that get adapted into animated shows, like, think of Toy Story was really popular, and so they made that Buzz Lightyear show. Well, Tim Allen wasn't going to come voice Buzz Lightyear every week. He had a lot of work to do. You know, he was getting all those Santa Claus movies and whatever else he was doing.
Well, Tom Hanks kept begging to get put on that.
You know, wasn't it Tom Hanks' brother, or was it Tim Allen's brother?
It was Tim Allen's brother who ended up doing the voice of Buzz Lightyear.
I think Tom Hanks' brother might have done the voice as well. It's like, he's like the Frank Stallone of voice actors. But those doors aren't necessarily open for a lot of franchises that make the way into animated TV shows, whereas, like, Star Trek, these actors were actually available.
Yeah.
And that's kind of a rarity.
So I want to go back on something else that you had brought up earlier with regards to just how the sky's the limit, you know, imagination wise, mm-hmm. just because you're not, you know, hamstrung by some of the budgetary constraints here. But episode one of the first season, I'm blanking on the name. Is it like The Farthest Planet or The Farthest Star?
Beyond the Farthest Star.
Beyond the Farthest Star. The thing that I was like, oh, this is creative, like, whoever's writing this one, that they've got a good idea here. But the life support belts,
right,
where they throw them on kind of this dead dying ship, and the crew's wearing these life support belts where they can actually walk around even though it's not a safe atmosphere. I'm just like, it's kind of cheesy.
It is.
It wouldn't work on this series.
Yeah.
But it somehow works, like, on an animated series.
I like those belts where it just has, like, the yellow beam around them.
Yeah.
I'm like, that's kind of cool. But, like, it's a fun idea.
We also do find ourselves in moments, and, you know, Beyond the Farthest Star was guilty of this, where I'm watching Scotty at a moment where he's obviously trying to shoot his phaser.
Yeah.
And I think the animators forgot to put a phaser beam on. So I'm just like, imaginative as it was, a lot of it was just like, oh, they ain't paying attention. They don't really give a crap.
One of my favorite moments in any given animated series episode is when something really dramatic happens and it has the characters look to one another, but it's just like these dead face stares. There's no expression.
Yes.
And it cuts between like two or three of them.
Actually,
and it's like, well, I'm guessing they're trading some sort of vibes off each other. I'm getting nothing.
Nothing will delight me more than watching any of these animated characters run.
In oh,
that
yeah, yeah.
The animators don't know how to animate running.
Right.
They look silly no matter what.
Yeah.
I'm just like, okay, you know. Like, you can pick out some episodes that weren't super strong. I overall just found it very charming. Mm-hmm. If you were a fan at the time, Cam, would you not be delighted that Star Trek's making a return to TV? Is this something that you could kind of appreciate for what it was at the time?
Definitely. And what I love about the animated series, and it's something I hope Lower Decks does too, is exploit the canon of Star Trek just for references and for kind of in-jokes.
Yes.
Because I love how the animated series will bring back characters from the original series and how you all have just, you know, references to things that happened in original series episodes just off the cuff. Like, there's an episode where Kirk just references the events of Journey to Babel. And it's like, oh, cool. Like, I watched that episode.
Yeah.
Or you have the Return to the Planet from Shore Leave. And that's the sort of stuff animation is really easy to do with. And I really enjoy that aspect of the animated series. Because a lot of the time, Star Trek, when it gets more into the 24th century era, a lot of the time they felt hesitant about referring to past episodes because they didn't want to confuse people with syndication. But it's like in a kid's show, no one cared.
Yeah, exactly.
And I love that.
Yeah, I think they definitely had like more creative leeway at that particular moment, too. And I was about to suggest with regards to what you're saying, is they could even bring back old characters like Sarek. But then I realized that, well, no, it's like Sarek hasn't really aged at all. So you don't need to have kind of the animation like fix all the wrinkles that would exist on the actor anyway.
Right.
So, but it was fun to see what they could do. The other thing that you brought up, though, is the continuity thing. And for the longest time, I kind of dismissed the animated series because, you know, the going thought was that this was not necessarily canon.
Right.
You look into it, as you said, DC Fontana was very adamant. No, we always, you know, approach us as if it was canon. Mm-hmm. I believe David Gerald, he didn't name any name specifically, but David Gerald, one of the other writers on this series, is like, no, it was always canon until... you know, late 80s, early 90s, a certain individual who worked for Gene Roddenberry thought he was in charge of deciding what was canon and was what was not, and then just arbitrarily declared that it was non-canon, whereas for the longest time, it was considered canon. So I've kind of come around on my thinking on the animated series, because I watch it, and there's nothing in there that I find, like, kind of egregiously awful, that there's no way I can rationalize some of, like, kind of the animated...
Sure.
Rendition of what's going on.
I mean, some of it is definitely very, very broad in a way you could never do in live action, you know. There's an episode called the Ambergris Element. Forgive me out there if I've mispronounced that word, but whatever. Where Kirk and Spock become like water breathers and live underwater. You know, things like that you could never do in live action. It would look pretty goofy.
Sure.
So I can understand how it's a little tough to sometimes wrap your head around the animated series and be like, yeah, this could not really line up so well with, you know, the Next Generation adventures and the original series adventures. But I can understand from the point of view of just the writers, there's a lot of things in the animated series that became kind of canon. You know, you had the first quote-unquote potential holodeck.
Yeah, The Practical Joker.
Yeah, you had the first mention of Tiberius being Kirk's middle name in the episode BAM. They had a reference, Kor references his ship as the ISS Clothos, which was referenced in a Deep Space Nine episode. The writers would often down the road just pick little bits out of the animated series and use them
I think, canon? Wasn't there even a reference to yesteryear in the J.J. Abrams movie with regards to, you know, like a Spock's pet?
Yeah.
You know,
yeah,
so
the Saylot became something that was referenced a few times. And then we even saw references to that episode in the Enterprise Vulcan arc, too, with the creature in the desert.
So, I think it's definitely a show that Star Trek fans should not dismiss. But let me ask you this, though. Why do you think it maybe never gained traction among hardcore fans? You know, you and I were both hardcore fans.
Mm-hmm.
You go to the conventions. I don't see much animated series merch going on.
Yeah.
The most I really saw was there was a guy dressed up last year, and he was wearing a shirt, a TOS uniform, and on the back it said, Kirk is a jerk.
Which is amazing. That's from the Practical Joker episode.
Yeah, it's a good
There's
reference.
There's a lot of actually really funny moments in the animated show.
There is, yeah. This is, again, why I think that the Lower Deck series is actually going to work pretty well.
Yeah.
But, I mean, from your perspective, how come this, you know, despite, like, kind of all the, you know, cool stuff that was going on here, how come it didn't quite catch on with hardcore fandom camp?
I think there's a couple of reasons. I think the animation, because it's so stiff, it doesn't age well. I think a lot of younger Star Trek fans would watch a show and be like, ugh, I'm having trouble watching this.
Yeah.
I think that's part of it. And let's be honest, the voice actors are often a little stolid.
There were a few moments where I was like, oh, actually, I'll give DeForest Kelly, like, props.
He's great.
Like,
he actually seems to really be delivering.
Yeah, but a lot of times it's like, oh, Nimoy and Shatner are just phoning it in. But not every single time, but there's some clear episodes where you could tell these guys just did not want to be there.
Right.
Which, to me, if I was an actor, I'd be like, you know what? I want to give it my all.
Right.
You know, so.
I wonder if part of it is just the difference between, like, a stage actor or, you know, movie actor versus, like, a voice actor. Doohan was obviously a voice actor at heart. Like, he really had those abilities. Nichelle Nichols is a singer, so she's very good with her voice. And I just wonder how much was just Shatner and Nimoy being uncomfortable with the process to a certain degree, and maybe even feeling like they were slumming.
Well, I would say yes. They probably felt like they were slumming. And also, the other old adage in acting is reacting.
Mm-hmm.
If they're just going in there and they don't have anybody to bounce off of,
mm-hmm.
I think I can understand why maybe it sounds pretty stiff at times, you know? Like, they're not... I would guess it's, you know, Shatner is not in the same sound booth as Nimoy, and they're going back and forth reading lines to each other. I bet they're recording this in different sessions, so it's just kind of like, okay, well, there you go. Like,
and even if they are together, sometimes it's a little bit start, stop when it comes to animation, so that can throw off the whole flow, too.
What about when Krusty the Clown had to go record the, was it the Krusty the Clown doll, like, lines?
Yeah.
And he read them all, like I imagine Shatner did, you know, in certain sessions.
Yeah.
The best gag, though, is then the sound engineer, after we hear Krusty read all the lines, the sound engineer turns around and pushes record button. He's like, okay, Krusty, ready to hear you now. Krusty's already left.
Yeah. That was all taken from real life from the William Shatner recording sessions.
I can imagine that. Yeah.
But you'd see, like, Nimoy would get good at this sort of thing when it came to The Simpsons.
Oh, yeah.
Because when he came back and did The Simpsons years later, he was amazing. So I just wonder, you know, if you look at Disney movies of the era, of that 70s era, it's not like they were locking down grade A talent. It's like there was a division between people that did animation and people who did live action films or stage or what have you.
Yeah. Kim, let me ask you this. Maybe what was your favorite episode of the animated series?
I think you have to say yesteryear.
Yeah.
I think that tends to come with the territory with the animated series. It's funny. If you look at the list of the episodes on IMDb, it's like that one is really highly rated and the rest are all really weakly rated.
I did notice that. I went on IMDb as well. I'll give it to yesteryear. I mean, I watched that one the other day and I found it a very charming, you know, it's clearly a children's show.
Mm-hmm.
I get that, but I found it very charming. And look, you know, Pixar movies are family movies and there's still a lot to take away from it. That's of a lot of value there. And I got that from yesteryear. And I like to think that it does accurately fill out a lot of the backstory, that it kind of explains, you know, Spock's own kind of conflict within him.
Mm-hmm.
It also explains why I want to dress like a Vulcan boy all the time, which apparently they wear knee-high boots, tidy whiteies, but blue, and then like white sashes across their bare chests.
I can see what you're wearing right now.
Well, I know.
You don't have to describe it to me.
That to me was a very surreal moment when I found out what Vulcan boys wear on Vulcan. Is it because of the desert climate? It's just really hot?
It must be.
Okay.
I guess so.
How come we didn't see that as depicted in Star Trek 2009 when we got the flashback to...
That would have been so amazing.
I guess we could still look forward to Star Trek Discovery if there's more flashbacks to Vulcan. And
right.
It'd be an interesting... you know what? Maybe this is... Look, I was complaining how the Star Trek conventions don't have enough animated series fans. Yeah. I need to do this as cosplay.
I mean... I want to get back to the yesteryear, but just talking about the lack of animated merchandise, doesn't it feel like there's so many opportunities for fun merchandise that kind of kids a lot of maybe the clunkier moments in the animated series, but kind of lovingly? There's so many weird frames throughout that show that you could totally put on t-shirts and have funny
t-shirts.
Messages.
Yeah. Or just give me a life support belt.
Yeah,
you know,
there's all sorts of cool stuff.
Yeah, and it's kind of like, I wonder if CBS will clue into it after the Lower Decks and look at what's in their back catalog and say, hey, there's some more merch opportunities.
Well, they just did that whole new Star Trek 50th Anniversary box set where they remastered the animated series for Blu-ray, so maybe they're it's a little more on their minds. We'll see. But
how many copies do you think they sold, Cam?
Of the box set or the animated series separate?
The animated series.
Ooh. Well, I would be curious what the run was. I feel like it wasn't a large run. I don't know.
Do you think they sold their entire lot?
I can say this. They had a whole bunch of them at the Best Buy near where we live, which we tend to buy a lot of our stuff there. And they sold out fairly quick. I didn't get one. They didn't have hundreds.
I bought them all for myself.
They didn't have hundreds. They had probably like, you know, 8 or 10, but they were all gone in a fairly short amount of time.
Yeah.
So I don't know. I don't know what the distribution run was. And I feel like with home media now, it's very tough to determine what's actually popular.
Exactly.
But with yesteryear, another thing I think this episode is really good at, and I think it's interesting maybe after this to talk about some of the messages and some of the other episodes we've seen, is how it was conveying actually quite mature messages to kids in a way that still gave you all the Star Trek kind of high concept goofiness and character growth and all that sort of stuff. But, you know, it has this whole message with the Spock's pet, and it's very much a message for, like, kids with their own pets who have to face, you know, putting down their own animals one day.
Spock's pet was the best follow-up we could ever hope for following Spock's brain.
It really was. It was better.
Yeah.
But, like, you know, the whole story of Aichaya, that's pretty heartbreaking stuff. And I think to show that to a kid on a, you know, 8 a.m. Saturday morning cartoon or whenever it aired, you know, that's pretty gutsy stuff. And getting to some of the other messages of other episodes, you know, you have, like, them encountering the devil in the Magics of Megas 2, the Mayan God episode I referenced earlier. Like, that's pretty heady stuff to be exposing kids to. And I kind of admire the show for going that far.
It was, like, fairly adult at times. I'm thinking about the episode Jihad. And we have the woman who tells Kirk...
Okay, that woman is amazing. Lara?
Yeah, she's like, I'm from a planet of mainly women. If we like men, we just tell them, I like you.
It's like, James, have I told you I find you attractive lately?
Like, there's some, like... It's a pretty funny show.
Yeah, she was awesome.
When we did our Hidden Gems episode a couple years back, you suggested a counterclock incident. Mm-hmm. And it is a episode that I can appreciate more at the time. But when I was watching it then, I made fun of it a lot.
Yeah, yeah.
To be fair,
a lot of your making fun of it was really funny. And it wound up, I think, on our Best of the Year episode. I think that's from our Hidden Gems episode. I will post a link to that in the show notes.
But it was like, there's a lot to, like, revere from that one. It just filled with so many, like, inside references. But I think it might be the funniest animated series episode that I've seen out of probably I guess I must have watched maybe, you know, 10 or 12 at this point.
Right.
And just, like, how ridiculous the animated stuff could be.
Yeah, definitely. Because that has that whole scene where they're, like, meeting that woman's son, who's like an old man and she's young.
Yeah.
And it's so funny. So funny. And Robert April's wife's flower.
Well, like the crew starts turning into babies.
Yeah.
You know, like we're looking at like, and anyway. Yes.
There's also the episode, the Territon incident, where they all shrink. And that's actually a really funny episode too. Yep. And I've seen some GIFs of that online that are amazing.
So like, I think there's some, weirdness to the animated series. It's very much a very 70s show.
Oh, yeah.
It was not made that much longer after the original series ended in 1969.
Yeah.
But it seems so much like something of its era.
Well, you know, it does feel very 70s. You know, that episode that you referenced, the Jihad.
Yeah.
That's a whole episode where they're on a breathless quest.
Yeah.
And it feels like they're in slow motion for the entire time. And I like that there's all these moments where the characters just stand still and are like, well, let's take a rest. And you're like, okay, I guess. Not a lot of urgency going on here.
But I also think of just the fact that if you look at Laura's hair,
yeah,
it looks like 70s hair. It's like, it doesn't matter that it's animated.
Yeah.
It's 70s hair.
Right.
Whereas I think,
it's kind of like a prog rock album of the time.
Yeah, yeah. It really
like
is,
space
though.
Rock, yeah.
Yeah.
You have all these really weird creatures gathered with them, which, again, that's what I want more of in Star Trek Animated, is all these variety of aliens that I've never seen before.
There's literally a giant bird alien,
yeah.
A warrior species that would fly. Like, yeah. That you can't really get away with that on a TV budget, even a huge budget like Discovery's, without it looking really silly. Look, we had to watch Saru run last season.
Yeah, and it did not work.
It looked really bad. And so I think if you had a flying alien in a live action series, you'd be like, okay. Animated series, I'm going with this flying warrior bird man. Like, yeah. It's kind of like, I totally buy it. It's much easier to suspend your disbelief, like, for something like this.
No, I agree 100%. And I just love the idea of the artists being completely untethered in terms of their creative process of saying, I want to make a really weird looking alien, and I don't want to have to think about an actor and how they're going to wear this outfit or how the CG artists are going to put it together. Because, yeah, in that episode, the Jihad, there's like that character who's like the quote unquote coward of the group, who's
right.
Like this green little alien who has like all these little hands.
Kind of worm guy, centipede almost.
Yeah. And they would never put that in a live action show, and that character wouldn't work.
Yeah.
And if they CG'd him, you'd have probably something along the lines of the insectoid Zindis, which, you know. Look, they worked on a functional level, but they didn't look great.
Yeah.
I can you know, enjoy episodes where they're in it, but they don't look great.
Yeah.
And so, no, I just think there's so much possibilities there. I do have one final question before we wrap up this episode for you, though. Do you think animation will save Star Trek for, like, kids? Do you think it will help spawn something? Or do you think, because it's on something like CBS All Access, it is ultimately going to fall into a niche audience that is kind of playing to the converted?
So I feel conflicted here, because I thought for the longest time, you know, Star Trek is for families. Star Trek should be for kids.
Definitely.
I discovered Star Trek when I was a kid. You watch Star Trek Discovery, it's not a kid's show. Yeah, mm-hmm. I wouldn't recommend it to kids. And I think it's fine in that I think Star Trek needs to diversify. I'll genuinely be, you know, a little surprised if we get to the Picard spinoff and we hear, you know, F-bombs like we do in Discovery.
Sure.
Or we see, you know, alien nudity like we do in Discovery.
Right.
So I definitely think that we need to see more of that demographic diversity within Star Trek. You bring up the fact that it's going to be on CBS All Access. Is that going to keep it away from younger audiences who may not have access to it? Kids are smart. Like, you should see my niece, who knows exactly how to get Dora the Explorer on Netflix.
Right.
I think kids are going to be able to figure out what's on the back catalog of CBS All Access. A whole lot of episodes of Murder, She Wrote. And, you know, some Star Trek The Lower Decks, too.
Well, I hope so. Okay, so on that note, our assignment is complete. If you enjoyed listening to this podcast, we want to hear from you. Jump on over to our Facebook page at facebook.com/subspacepod. Tyler, what are we doing next week? We already teased it.
Yeah, we are continuing what we call Smort Treks, our reviews of the short treks by Smith and Orton, hence Smort Treks. So the next one is going to be Calypso. I'm really looking forward to this one. I think this has the potential to be the strongest short trek that we're going to get, period, out of the four.
I thought you were
going to
say so far.
So far, I think it's a very low bar.
Yeah.
I think you and I were incredibly diplomatic about the way we approached Runaway.
Yeah.
I think that was a pretty bad adventure that we had to witness.
How much of it is even sticking in your mind at this point?
I can remember Tilly being in a food fight,
yeah,
and somehow beaming the stowaway off the ship.
Yeah.
We're still not sure where to.
Yeah.
You know? I don't know. It wasn't very good. But yeah. I like the Tilly moments. I remember the Tilly stuff with her mom. Mm-hmm. That was good. But I don't. It wasn't a very fun adventure. This seems to have like a good kind of hook to it. Mm-hmm. We won't spoil it, but I'm looking forward to tackling Calypso next week.
You've really pinned your hopes on this one as the savior of short treks, smart treks. So let's hope so.
Don't remind me.
Okay, so you can also find us on the Twitter. I'm at Cam, V as in Vulcan, Infinite Vulcan, Smith.
And you can find me at Reportin, that's R-E-P, P as in Phantasm Ravager, O-R-T-O-N.
Okay, so until next time, the arena is closed.
Transfer complete.